This is 69 the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been online now for more than a decade, writing about the digital signage industry and filtering all the BS. Now 69 is also a podcast, a chance to talk to smart people doing interesting things in this business. You can listen to episodes online, get it from iTunes or Google Play, or use your favorite podcast app to grab the RSS feed. 69 is sponsored and supported by ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. Rich Ventura now has the launch codes and the secret handshakes to act as the 2017 chairman of the Digital Signage Federation. He's been active in the organization for several years, and he has big plans for the year ahead. He'll go into that in the latter half of this podcast, but we spend the first part of it talking about his role as VP of Business Development and Solutions at NEC Display. We talk about how NEC operates and what makes it different, newish technologies out there like Raspberry Pi, the overall state of the flat panel industry, the emergence of direct view LED, and a pile of other topics. We also talk about what the signage industry, and particularly the display side of it, looks like in 2017 and beyond. Rich, what's your role at NEC?
Vice President of Business Development and Solutions.
And that encompasses a whole bunch of things because I see you everywhere.
Yep. What the role of my team is, we are, we kind of carry three roles within the company. We lead kind of the strategic direction of the organization. So basically, I always look at it 1, 3, and 5 years. So stuff that we're working on is stuff that is going to be, we're going to be selling or become common form for us a year from now. But then we're also understanding, analyzing, and studying the markets and what vertical markets are going to be doing what 3 years from now. Mm-hmm. And then 5 years from now, we're looking at what's really the direction and what's NEC going to be 5 years from now. So we always talk about what we call the midterm plan, and all Japanese companies do this, and it's your 3-year plan. That's really the DNA of my team. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece. The other piece is we're the vertical market specialists. So I have people in different key vertical markets for the organization that is analyzing the market, spending time in the market, attending conferences, engaging with user groups, partners, you name it, in order to really, you know, strengthen NEC's penetration and into those markets. And then the last piece is we manage what we call the alliance partners. Mm-hmm. So technology partners, so be it the CMS companies, the mount companies, you name it. And you know, some of the CMS guys, they're also integrators of ours. And so we don't manage that part of the relationship. We manage much more the strategic part of the relationship.
Right. What kind of autonomy do you have from Japan? Or is the U.S. business unit kind of its own thing? Or do you work pretty closely with Japan?
You know, it's kind of cool what we do. So we work really, really closely with Japan. We work very closely with our European counterparts as well. In fact, most of the senior leadership, we were all in Munich last week just for Christmas. We do twice a year meetings between us and our European counterparts to talk about various issues or stuff that we're dealing with from a global perspective, either global account management, partner management, strategy, and direction. You know, we don't operate 100% autonomously from Japan. I mean, they are the mothership. We do have to go to them for product and approvals for certain different things, but we do also operate as our own business unit.
I'm curious, the flat panel business from sitting here in the bleachers looks hyper, hyper competitive. How does NEC kind of differentiate itself from the Samsungs, the LGs, and all the other guys?
It's amazing how competitive it is. One of the key things that we always talk about with everybody is, you know, we're not TV makers, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about our product being on the shelves at a retailer. So our focus is 100% on commercial products. So we're building products with feature sets, technologies, add-ons, so on and so forth that are for the commercial application. So you look at things like OPS technology, which we're one of the founders with Intel and Microsoft. You look at our color calibration platforms. You look at the recent announcement and the upcoming shipment of the Raspberry Pi module. You know, we really focus at the commercial level. The other thing that really differentiates NEC from our competition is we're very solution oriented. You know, when Todd Bowman came on board, our president, you know, he talked about three really important things: solutions, global, and being easy to do business with, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at us as an organization, global, we operate better than anybody in the industry. Like I said earlier, you know, we communicate daily, weekly, monthly, you name it, with our counterparts in Europe, APAC, China, you name it. You know, our Latin America team, that falls underneath our organization, and we've got a great team down there. Solutions, I don't know of any other display companies who can truly deliver solutions the way that we've been able to do it. We've been doing it for a long time. I mean, we started the solutions organization at NEC 13 years ago.
And how do you define solutions?
Well, solutions are, you know, that's always the hardest part, is everybody goes, well, a solution could be a monitor, a mount, and a screen, right? And I go, no. A solution has to truly solve a problem. Mm-hmm. And it's not bundles. Bundles are bundles, right? Bundles to me are not solutions. Bundles are a product that might solve a normal problem, but it's not customized and designed. So we're doing things like we're working with our integrators in helping support them with services capabilities. So some of our integrators work with us where we supply installation services to them. We might do some design services for them, software configuration services. But it's really building out an entire solution that can solve the problem beyond just a monitor, a mount, and a media player.
You mentioned the Raspberry Pi module that you're doing. You're kind of the one big display manufacturer that hasn't gone down the path of system-on-chip displays. You could argue that what you're doing is, but it's not. It's a different animal. So why that path?
So if you look at the history of NEC, if you remember the term multi-sync, and mm-hmm. it's a pretty important brand and term that people forget about sometimes. So if you go back 25, almost 30 years ago, and you were to buy a monitor, you had to buy an EGA video card or a CGA card. You had to buy a special card to work with that monitor. And NEC saw that and said, you know, that's a problem. It's a pain point for the industry. Why not create a technology that can sync to a computer with simplicity and ease, so you don't have to buy a special cards? And so multi-sync was born. And, you know, throughout our history, we've always said we're a non-proprietary organization. We support industry standards. You know, we were the first ones to even have DVI back on our CRTs. And I'm talking 16, 17 years ago, we had CRTs with DVI on them. Mm-hmm. Now it's pretty much a standard, right? So the whole idea with multi-sync was not to have anything proprietary. Then you take in the whole idea of OPS, which is an industry standard, and say having the ability of upgrade, which is really important. If a customer wants to upgrade their player because they need something that's a faster processor, the application changes, so on and so forth, they're able to replace that in the OPS slot. Same idea on the Raspberry Pi. Why go down the route of having a proprietary platform built into our displays that A, is not removable, so if it needs to be serviced or upgraded, and B, what happens when, you know, 2 years from now when your application changes and you're stuck with old technology? Mm-hmm. So we looked at a lot of different ideas and avenues, and this was the most natural fit. I mean, Raspberry Pi is an open platform. You know, we're seeing Microsoft supporting it with Windows IoT Edition. We're seeing a lot of schools are actually adopting Raspberry Pi as a way to teach students how to write code. And so it's really an amazing platform. Now, it's not the platform that says, okay, we can use Raspberry Pi in every single application. We'd be really kind of blind and stupid to say mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of great applications for Raspberry Pi. But yeah, we looked at the whole idea of the idea that has come out of SoC of it being an embedded player inside the screen just doesn't go with, you know, our history and our legacy within the industry.
Right. And so the way this will work with the Raspberry Pi is it's a snap-in board, and let's say 2 years from now, will the company that's developing the Raspberry Pi continue to have that form factor so the new upgraded board will just snap in the same way, or at you a risk of it not fitting anymore?
Well, that's the great thing about the platform. It's a standard platform. You know, we have an I/O slot in the back of the display. So there's a little door that you open and there's an I/O slot so then they can put the chip in there. It's following a lot of the standardization that's coming on board for that type of technology.
Okay.
So companies like Intel are looking at that form factor and technology as well to introduce product to. So we chose to go with a standardization platform. So obviously anything could always change in our industry. You know, we change daily, right?
Yeah.
But based on everything that we know, hear, and see, it's a continued platform. So down the road, you could put in, put in the latest and greatest.
Right.
Also, the key thing that's important with what we're doing on Raspberry Pi is we'll have a build version that we want, which will be, I think, around 16 gigs of storage. But you can use any of the Raspberry Pi 3 modules in there. So you're not locked into saying you can only buy the NEC Raspberry Pi 3 module.
Okay.
You can buy it directly from Raspberry Pi. You can have it with Raspbian. You can have it with Ubuntu. You could have it Windows IoT Edition.
Okay. I remember talking to another guy in the industry 2-3 years ago, and he said, watch it, the Chinese display companies are coming, and they're going to be a real problem for the Koreans and the Japanese companies. And I thought, well, that makes sense, but I don't know that I've ever seen it happen. Am I missing it, or it just hasn't happened?
It's happened in the TV industry.
Uh-huh.
We've seen it pretty heavily in the TV industry. I think a lot of it still comes down to trust, although there's still a lot of applications going out there and deals that are going out there that are not going with one of the big, you know, the big four of us, big four or five of us on the display side, right? And it tends to be, a lot of times it tends to be in like manufacturing application, basically places that just don't care and they want to spend $100 for a 42-inch LCD and they really don't care, right?
Right.
I haven't really seen like a Chinese company jump up in front of us or LG or Samsung or Sharp or Panasonic. I mean, granted, Sharp's owned by Foxconn, so you kind of have a Chinese company now in the play, right?
Yeah.
But it's not like any of the other ones we're seeing it happen. I mean, I think part of it is, at least what we've seen, is it's pretty easy to start your own company in China and say that you have a factory and you have all this stuff, and then stuff hits the fan and you have problems, and all of a sudden that company's no longer around, and hey, guess what? A new company just pops up in China, and it's the same guy you're dealing with at the other company.
Mm-hmm.
We just haven't seen it. We haven't seen it in any of the big deals. I mean, we've seen it in little stuff, but nothing in any major deals that really mean anything.
Right. I guess the other big challenge is there's not a whole lot of margin in this business.
There isn't. And the other thing, too, is these Chinese companies don't have the infrastructure in the U.S.
Right.
You know, they don't have a service infrastructure. They don't have a channel infrastructure. They don't understand the channel the way that, you know, that those of us who've been in the market for a long time understand.
Mm-hmm.
So that stuff plays against them as well. You know, will we see it? Yeah, we will. And I think what we're going to see is we're going to probably see more of the Chinese influx be in the direct view LED space.
Okay.
And we will in the direct, and then we will in the LCD space. Because the Chinese companies are going nuts in the direct view LED space.
Yeah, that's going to be my next question. NEC got into that a little over a year ago. You had a partnership with a German company, and since then you've put together your own product, correct?
Yeah. So we've actually been in it much longer. It's just The U.S. market wasn't right. We were selling it for quite a few years in Europe. In fact, if you go to there's some fairly large installations in the U.K., and in the EMEA market and parts of Europe that are utilizing the LED, the direct view LEDs.
Mm-hmm.
When we first launched it here in the States, we looked at it and said, oh, we'll just sell it like we sell displays through the channel. Well, that doesn't work right. So we really had to look at how do we do this. And it's really, especially when you're dealing with the ultra fine pitch stuff, it's really a handholding type of business. You really need to work with the integrator and with the partner and make sure that the right products being bought, the right service programs being placed, they understand the configurations, the way to send the video and all that stuff. Because while it's a display, it's still a very sensitive and unique technology.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of education you have to do around resolutions and pixel pitches and all that stuff, right?
There is. And on top of all that stuff, it's service and support. Because, you know, our product's front is front serviceable. So you can take the panels off the front. Mm-hmm. The thing you have to understand is you can't just pop them off. You just pop them off, you start destroying the LEDs.
Right.
And so you need to use special tools to do that. And then make sure you have the right solutions. I mean, one of the great things that we focused on was making this a very easily serviceable platform, but also an easily upgradable platform. So if customer, say, buys a 3.5 millimeter fine pitch for inside, and then a year from now they want to go down to a 1.2, they don't have to replace all their infrastructure. They really have to replace the LED boards.
Right. So all the mounts and everything else and cabling can stay.
Yep, the chassis, the whole nine yards. So, you know, we focused on how do we deliver that type of solution, because just like I said earlier, it's not a proprietary solution. It's a solution to make things easier for the customers.
Mm-hmm. Is it tougher to sell against all the, you know, the no-name companies coming out of Shenzhen that have product, and at first glance, well, this looks as good as that one, but that's way cheaper, so I'll go with that.
Well, yes and no. So the key thing you have to look at, and this is a big thing that we talk about, is understanding what kind of LED lights they're using. I mean, are they using Chias? What bulbs are they using? So that's really important, because if you go to the sign industry shows, and I don't know if you've ever been to like ISA, yeah. the International yeah. Science Show, it's like LED, it's like Chinese LED world, right?
Yeah.
Where you look, it's all these Chinese LED suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
But you start talking to them and you say, okay, what kind of LEDs are you using? Are you using Cree? Are you using a Chia? What are you using? And once we start understanding that, we start going, okay, well, we know what their failure rates are going to be like. We know what the quality is. We know how to sell against that and really position against it. Unfortunately, sign industry is, the DSF has done an awesome job, and Alan Braun has done a great job in educating them. The problem is the sign industry guys still focus on price.
Right.
And that's been the toughest part.
Okay.
Is getting over that price piece.
So let's talk about price. When I see the fine pixel pitch or super fine pixel pitch stuff, I think that's amazing. And then I start asking, well, how much does this cost per square meter? And then I go, okay, this needs to come down a little bit. What's the timeline when an indoor, a direct view LED wall starts to be at some degree of parity with an LCD wall of the same dimension?
We still got a ways to go. Problem we've had is LCDs have degraded so much in value. Or not value, let me rephrase that. They've degraded so much in price, right?
Right.
Value is always still very high, but it's degraded so much in price. Think about it. So I started NEC 16 years ago, right? And 16 years ago, we had a 15-inch LCD that we sold for $2,500.
Yep.
We had a 21-inch LCD, the only one in the industry, that we sold for $15,000. 16
yeah.
years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember closing this really large deal when I was a sales rep 13 years ago, and it was like 6,000 15-inch LCDs, and I about died when we cut the deal to the customer for $475 a panel.
Uh-huh.
Today, I mean, you're buying 22s for, under $200, right? I mean, it's just degraded. The large format, when we introduced the LCD 4000, I want to say we were shipping that product. Gosh, I want to say we were shipping it around $12,000 to $14,000 for the LCD 4000, the first 40-inch LCD. I mean, now you look where prices are at, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty massive degradation. I think we're going to see that with LED, but I think what we're going to see is probably like a 10 to 15% degradation year over year, whereas LCDs have kind of plateaued on that degradation. They're not degrading anywhere near as fast as they were. In fact, you constantly always hear about LCD shortages looming, and we may see prices go up. Now, the key thing that's going to be interesting is how did this holiday season end for the TV guys? If they're sitting on a lot of inventory, you know what happens, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you get a lot of new products introduced as commercial products, but they're actually TVs with a commercial logo slapped on.
Prosumer.
Exactly. And it's that, and so that's a big, 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 big problem in our industry.
And it's literally the same display panel, just it hasn't shipped from the factory, so they can rebadge it and just repackage it up as a prosumer display.
Yeah, and actually sometimes they're even repackaging them and shipping them to other countries.
Huh.
We've seen it. I mean, we've seen dumping in Canada by some companies, and we've seen dumping down in Latin America. I mean, it's illegal or anything. It's just that market where they can sell that product, right? It's a new product they can introduce into that market at a lower price point to move it and grow their market share.
There's a bunch of costs involved in putting this podcast together, so I'm very grateful for the support this podcast will get from our new and sole sponsor, ScreenFeed. Here's founder and CEO, Jeremy Gavin.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. As content people, we love great content, and we think Dave's doing a great job with this 69 podcast, which is why we've offered to sponsor it. If you'd like to see the content that we create on a daily basis, head over to screenfeed.com and check it out. Let us know if we can help you in any project you're working on. And do me a favor, if you don't find what you're looking for, shoot me an email at jeremy@screenfeed.com. I'm always interested in new ways we can help. Now back to the podcast.
I've heard one of the big arguments around DirectView LED is no seams at all. Therefore, it's more attractive to somebody like a retailer or a big museum or whatever. I've thought for the last couple of years the bezels are now so skinny that it seems like a bit of a wash. Like, who cares about a hairline grid? But is it still a determining factor?
It is. Some are still saying the same thing. I mean, I had a meeting with a customer a few weeks ago, and they're saying, I want no seams. I want no bezels. I want nothing. And I said, okay, fine. I get it. What, how big is the space? And they show me the space, and I go, okay, what resolution do you want? And they go, well, I want 4K. And I'm like, I'm going to tell you right now, it's not going to work. And he's like, why? And I go, the size of your space, I cannot fit a 4K DirectView LED in there. I said, I need four times the amount of space you're giving us to do it. Now, I said, there's two options to this. Option one is accept the displays, the video wall products, you know, our ultra narrow type products, our super ultra narrow products, and do a, and I think for them, we were talking about doing like a 3x3 video wall. So three across, three up, or one of our 4K laser projectors. And you got no seam, you're dealing with projection now.
Right.
And so, you know, we went back and forth for a while on it, and they haven't finalized what they're going to do yet, but we do hear the people say about the seams. They don't want to see the window panel or the window, you know, paneling to it. And I'm like, it's not like the old displays where you had a 2.5-3 inch bezel on it that created, you know, all of a sudden then you had 5 inches between screen to screen. It's not like that anymore.
Yeah, it truly did used to look like crap. But really these days, if you're back 20 feet or something, I don't know if you really even notice it.
Well, the key is, and here's where the key hits on that, though, is making sure you get a video wall product that makes sense.
Yeah.
Not only does it have that thin bezel, but also make sure it's color calibrated. Because then you open this whole other can of worms that if you don't color calibrate it, and you've got, say, a 3x3 wall, you could have 9 screens that look completely different from each other.
Right. So we're coming into the new year. The CES is coming right up, and then there's ISE and so on. What are the things that we're going to be hearing about in the display market in the next year? Is it going to be all about things like HDR and quantum dots and so on, or is there something else?
Well, we saw HDR and quantum dots pretty heavy last year at CES. I know that I'm hearing about some other new technologies that'll go against OLED. So it'll be very interesting to see a lot of that on the floor at CES. You know, I think we'll see more expansion of quantum dot. I always crack up. Whenever I do like presentations, I ask people to raise their hand who has a 4K TV at home. And there's so few people have 4K TVs at home. Mm-hmm. And then you go to CES and they're talking 8K. And I think I heard there's going to be a 16K in someone's booth. And I'm like, seriously?
Yeah.
I mean, we barely got people. We've got hardly anybody deploying 4K. And now you're talking 8K and 16K. So I think that, and then I think you know, the curved displays are continuing to attract attention, but more on the consumer side, unless you want a piece of artwork, and that's really where you look at stuff like that, like what LG has done with their stuff. It's a great looking piece of artwork.
Right.
I don't know the practicality of it yet, but it's definitely a nice piece of artwork. You know, the size threshold, most people aren't going, but most people realize that 98 inch is more than big enough.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we'll see much of that. I'll tell you the thing I found interesting was, if you go back 3 CESs ago, everyone was talking about lenticular 3D, right? Everywhere you looked was 3D, 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 3D.
Glasses-free 3D, yeah.
And then this last CES, and if you know, you walk in, you got the big LG booth. When you walk in, it wasn't 3D.
Yeah.
The big wall they had has been 3D the last 2 years. It wasn't 3D. So it was OLED. And so, I mean, obviously their focus is around OLED. So it'll be interesting. I mean, when we go to ISE, I love going to ISE, and I remember you going last year and stuff, and that's probably one of my favorite shows to go to, believe it or not, because it feels like you get CES, CEDIA, Infocom, and DSC all in one roof.
Yeah.
Or multiple routes, I should say. You know, I think we're going to continue. I think we're going to see a lot more integration of IoT technologies into the displays. So beyond where we're at today with media players, I think we're going to start seeing more integration of beacons and RFID and cameras and sensors and things like that that are going to really help push the IoT movement and help push towards, you know, helping organizations like ad networks and things like that understand truly who's in front of their screens.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why a display panel, if it's got a Raspberry Pi in it or something, it can't be its own sort of discrete on-premise server.
Yeah. Well, the problem you have on the Raspberry Pi is processing power. To get the really, I mean, to go, if you were just looking at age and gender, no problem. But you start adding in Dwell and you start adding triggers and you start adding in pulling down content like weather and things like that to help make a decision, you got to go a lot more powerful than a Raspberry Pi.
Gotcha.
But Raspberry Pi does introduce some very interesting ideas, though, for an analytics perspective.
Yeah, for sure. So you're the incoming chairman of the Digital Signage Federation. You were vice chairman for the past year?
Yep.
So what's going to be different? What's your mandate for 2017 now that you've got the launch codes?
Well, you know, each one of us, chairman and chairwoman, you know, we had Kim Cerubi was was the previous chairwoman. Each one of us have our legacies. So as you go through the years, you know, you look at the original legacy was around the Seal of Excellence. And then you had education, and then you had meet and greets, and we had regional councils. And then we, you know, Ken expanded us into international with DSF Europe. Randy spent a lot of time this year focused on the rebranding of the DSF, which our new website will be launching here fairly soon. But a lot of people got to see the new logo when we were all in New York, but really rebranding and refreshing the brand, right? What we also announced in New York was the creation of the Ad Council. And this is pretty exciting. This is part of my legacy. It's kind of funny. Everybody has one legacy, but somehow I'm going to end up with two legacies. The second being the truly integrating the integrators into the DSF. And I'll come back to that in a minute here. But, you know, with the Ad Council, one of the things that I've looked at is a big disservice that's been happening in the industry is the focus has always been around the biggest people in the industry and has been focused around television. But it's not going back to the fundamentals of okay, what truly is programmatic? How do you create a business for a digital out of home? How do you educate people in digital out of home? How do you get so that networks understand what ad agencies are looking for and agencies understand what brands are looking for and brands understand what digital out of home actually means for them, both from a perspective of how they do it, but also how does it become monetized? All those things, I think, kind of haven't been done the way that it should have been.
The argument would be, or the question would be, well, isn't that what the DPAA does?
It's what they're supposed to do. I'm not going to go into, you know, we definitely, you know, there's a place for all of us in the industry, right?
Yeah.
There's definitely not a DSF versus DPAA at all. I mean, the key thing to remember about the DSF is our number one mandate is education, right? We educate. We are a nonprofit organization for the industry. So we're focused on truly the industry as a whole, not the parts of the industry, but the whole industry as a whole.
Right.
And when we looked at this and we spent a lot of time talking with agencies and I spent a long time talking with brands and I talked to a lot of network operators, both small and big, just asking them, what are you guys lacking? What do you need? It was interesting. We had our meet and greets that we do every quarter as a DSF. We had our meet and greet earlier in December. We had it in Arizona, and we had had our board meeting or like that. But our meet and greet we did it over at the Musical Instrument Museum. And by the way, if you make it down to Arizona, you've got to go check this place out, Dave. It's amazing. It's an amazing facility. And so we're there, and Spencer Graham, will be my vice chairman, Spence grabs me and goes, Rich, you need to meet these guys. And this was a network company. It was a network operator out of San Diego, and they operate networks in oil change facilities all over the U.S. And they're telling me about their network, and they're telling me where their struggles are at. And every bit of their struggles hit dead on what we want to try to do from the DSF, mm-hmm. is really help these networks understand how to monetize their network, understand what is needed in order to grow their network, understand who's out there from a support perspective. And that's part of what I offered them, is that with some of our members, is that we can definitely network with them who are willing to share what's helped them in the past to grow their organizations. That's what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be only about the biggest few. Right. It needs to be about the industry as a whole, because we don't grow unless everybody understands how do you monetize a digital out-of-home network? How do you get analytics for a digital out-of-home network? How do you certify a digital out-of-home network? How do you grow one? How do you finance one? What software platforms are really good for digital out-of-home networks? Mm-hmm. What hardware platforms? That's being missed.
Right, and that is somewhat out of scope for what the DPAA, which is all about the agency business in New York, company in San Diego that mostly works in the oil change sector they're going to be a complete fish out of water in that environment.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they are. And here's the other key thing. The DSF is a global organization. We have DSF Europe. The way that the Ad Council is created, it consists of members from Europe as well as from North America. And then as we expand, if we expand into parts of South America or we expand into parts of APAC, their members, and they will have people that'll be part of that will come in and be part of the Ad Council. Mm-hmm. So it goes from being a US European centered organization to being a truly global organization.
Okay. So then integrators.
Yeah. So obviously that's a big part of what I do for a living, right? Is that, yeah. You know, we're a channel organization, and so we spend a lot of time with integrators. And what's always kind of, I don't know, I'll say fuddled me. I never understood why we have so few integrators involved in the DSF. Because I know they're doing digital signage. We sell to them for digital signage all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And part of it I found was a lot of them just didn't understand what the DSF stood for. Also, there was also the confusion that a lot of people had that DSF and DSE are the same organization. Which we're not, you know, they're the trade show, we're the association tied with their show. Mm-hmm. But also I think a lot of integrators were kind of scared of digital signage. They didn't really understand the software aspect of it. They understand the hardware, that's Cakewalk, that's what they do every day, right? Yeah. But a lot of them don't understand the software. And what they also don't realize is how much revenue they can generate by getting involved in this industry with things like managed services. And in fact, I spoke at a partner conference with one of our distributors here a couple weeks ago. And that was one of the things I asked. I had everybody in the room. I said, raise your hand if you guys do managed services. And about half the room raised their hand in managed services. And I said, okay, those have your hands up. How many of you do digital signage? And not a single one of them do digital signage.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I asked, why? And they're, oh, it's complicated. It's this. And I go, you guys realize that digital signage is just like managing a network. It's just like managing the switches and servers of networks. Same idea. You can actually charge for those things. And you should see the light bulbs start popping above everybody's heads. Mm-hmm. The integrators have such a great opportunity. And if you think about it, a lot of the digital signage software companies became integrators, not because they wanted to, but because they had to, because the integration community wasn't there. Guys like Diversified have spent a lot of money in really creating themselves as a digital signage integrator.
Yeah.
You take them, you have Uniguest, you know, you go down the list of these guys, Convergent and, you know, AVI SPL to a level as well. But there is a lot of opportunity. And the other key thing that is really important is what we're doing is we're creating an integrator committee. And this integrator committee really represents all the different aspects of integration. So it's, you know, large pro AV integrator. It's the traditional sign company integrator. It is the traditional reseller integrator. It is the CMS integrator. It's the distribution companies. And then also it's the direct marketers, the DMRs. So in this committee, there'll be six members, and each member you know, each one of those spots will be represented by somebody within the industry. And their job is to come, you know, to come back to us, just kind of like the ad council as well, and say, all right, what do you guys feel is the most important things that are impacting you today? Where do you think the DSF needs to supply more education or do more events around, so on and so forth, you name it. So I'm really excited about the integrator group. And, you know, we've really got some really great people that are going to be involved with the integration committee and also with the ad council, the same thing. We've got some phenomenal people that are going to be part of the ad council.
And these are mostly ad network operators, or are you getting agency people?
We got a little bit of everything. We've got software companies, integrator. We have software companies. We actually have an integrator. We have a couple brands, some very big brands. Mm-hmm. We have a couple ad networks. We also have a couple of agencies as well. So we've really, I wanted the ad council to be as diverse as possible, because I don't want one voice. I want it to be the voice of the industry, not a voice of each individual. And to even show you how much we're doing that, as you know, on the front end of DSE, there's the Digital Out of Home conference for the day. Mm-hmm. On Tuesday. The DSF is actually running that event this year. Mm-hmm. So we've put it on, and the plan is to brand that as a DSF event and really work closely with DSE on it. And I know you're part of it, and you know, I've been putting together the panels, and you look at who's on these panels. I mean, there's some big names that we've got involved in these panels, and it's a really, really strong curriculum for the day. And I'm pretty excited about what we're going to see.
It's just going to slump in that one part of the day when I'm talking. People can go for coffee then.
You know, and it's great because if you look at the way this day is set, I mean, we're talking about smart cities, IoT, omnichannel, mobile, programmatic buying, technology trends, global analytics. We're talking about all those key buzz points that every network operator, all the brands and the agencies are asking about.
Right. Last question. What's your overall kind of outlook, attitude for the coming year and a half in the context of the industry? Are you optimistic, pessimistic, confused, excited? All of the
above?
I'm
always excited every year. And you know, it's funny because I'll spend like the last month, and about half of the last month is just closing stuff out for the calendar year. You know, we run under the Japanese business calendar, so our fiscal year doesn't actually end until March.
Okay.
So we're not in the scramble of ending the year. Obviously, we're still in the scramble of ending a quarter. But I'm always excited to see what everyone's saying that they saw this year, and then what are they seeing coming. And then we go into CES, and we're going to see a lot of technology trends. And we go to ISE, we're going to see a lot of technology trends. And then we end March with DSE, and we'll see a lot of technology trends, right? But I'm always excited to see what's going to happen. And, you know, I look at it from a vertical perspective, but then I also look at it application specific. And, you know, last year I talked a lot towards the end of the year about, you know, 2016 is going to be a heavy, heavy year for interactivity, not just for digital signage, but interactivity as a whole. So collaboration stations, kiosks, wayfinding, interactive touchscreens, all of that technology. And you know what? It's been a really exciting year for that. We've seen some really cool stuff. I also remember talking that maybe this year we'll finally see 4K kind of blow up. Well, we still haven't seen that yet. We're optimistic that it's going to happen.
Still need content.
You know, that's a key thing, is you need content. And you know, we've got some great content companies out there like Movie Murals that do some amazing 4K stuff. It's really cool what they're doing. But it's the pipe, it's the networks, it's all those different pieces, right? And that gets back to the whole comment about solutions, is making sure you're selling a product or a grouping of products that A, you know, will work, and B, help solve a pain point. Anyone can throw into a box a monitor, a computer, and a mount and pray that it works, right?
Yep.
But true solutions, you know, the stuff works, you've integrated, you've tested it, it has all those pieces to it, right? I think Raspberry Pi is going to make it's going to be very interesting this coming year. We don't start shipping for a couple more months still, but I'm really excited about seeing what that's going to do for the industry. Seeing what Microsoft is going to do with IoT Edition is going to be very interesting, because I think they might be realizing that they lost some share to Android that they could have prevented a long time ago. Chrome has always been that outlier. When does Chrome explode in the industry? And you know, every time you think they're about to, they don't win that deal, or somebody postpones a deal. So it's gonna be very interesting to see that. I think the video wall business is going to explode with DirectView LED. We're already seeing fewer opportunities in like 2x2 and 3x3 configurations of LCD. So I think DirectView is going to do that. I think the projector business, especially with the laser-based projectors and the projection mapping capabilities that they that they give, that's going to be massive. We've seen it. We've seen bits here and there, but I think we're going to really see some explosion on it. It usually happens. You know, we looked at the Olympic Games, and the Olympic Games had a lot of projection mapping at it.
Yeah.
And I think people were starting to realize, well, you know, this is kind of cool. We can do these things now.
Yeah. I think you're going to see projection mapping all the way down to like college sports and, you know, for NCAA basketball games, because, you know, the software is at a point where it's just easy to do.
Well, we're already seeing, you know, what's surprising is we're already seeing it in places you wouldn't think you'd see it in. We're seeing it in nightclubs. We're seeing it in bars.
Yeah.
We're seeing projection mapping on government buildings. Heck, I mean, you go to any hockey game, any professional hockey game, any professional basketball game, they're doing projection mapping already, right?
Yeah.
I think we're going to see more of it, and I think we're going to see retailers starting to utilize it even more, because it is a cheaper alternative than putting a massive video wall in. And the great thing is they can change the content to do just about anything anytime they want.
Yep. And with laser, you don't have to change the damn bulb every 500 hours.
That's important. I mean, you're talking extended use products. I mean, we talk about 20,000 hours on our lasers. You're introducing a whole new dynamic. And so, yeah, I'm very bullish on laser technology for projectors.
Hmm. All right. Well, we ran way the hell over time, but it was a great conversation.
Always great talking to you.
All right. I will see you probably, well, at a minimum at ISC in a few weeks.
Yep. I'll see you then.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and that you learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net, every day. 16.9 the blog and now the podcast are both properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.